Welcome, everyone, and thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about your experience and your world. And today is March 16th, 2018. And on today's show, we will be discussing A Course in Miracles with writer, web designer, and ACIM teacher Bruce Rawls. Now, specifically, we are going to be looking at lesson 79 and probably 80. 79 is, let me recognize the problem so it can be solved. And in fact, I was looking over in the chat room and laughing already because a number of people are there. And, Greg, I think it is, posted a picture of the old Seinfeld show and it says, why must there always be a problem? And, you know, that these lessons, 79 and 80, whenever I come to them, it really is like, oh, yeah, I forgot. You know, these two, I think, just stand alone as such a hologram to the entire course and what it is about. And so when, you know, something came up this week, and that's just what it even felt like. In fact, even this morning, you know, it was sort of like I had, you know, called to donate a piece of furniture. And of course, they go, well, we can come early Friday morning. And I'm like, well, of course you can, because that's when I've already got something scheduled, you know. And so that's it. We just get into this cycle of problem. And in some ways, we have no intention of getting out of that cycle. We want to, you know, I in particular want to see myself as victimized by, yeah, there's just one thing after another. When is the other shoe going to drop? When is this ever going to stop? And then you get to this lesson, let me recognize the problem so it can be solved. And the next one, let me recognize that it has been solved. There are no problems. You only have one problem. That is that you feel separated from God, that you believe that the separation is even possible, but that's not. So there is no problem. So get over it already. Now, of course, living on planet Earth, I'm not sure we're ever going to get to this point. In fact, I was kind of thinking as people are listening today, I thought if there's anybody listening who doesn't think that life is just one series of problems, I want to know how you did it, you know, because it's like, I think everybody could relate to this. However, what we'll really see and what happens is, yeah, how many times do we have to be told that there is a solution? But this is one of those, you know, as we go through these lessons, this is another time when I just feel like, you know, if I would just pay a little bit of attention, sometimes I want to make everything so complex. I want to make everything so complicated. And you know what? That's the problem in itself. If I would just kind of stop and, you know, every time I kind of think, okay, there is this tall ladder to heaven and I have to climb it rung by rung and I have to do this and I have to do that and I have to become enlightened. It's like, no, not really. There is a simple solution. And every single day, every single moment, you can turn to that. I mean, this is the lesson, really. When I read it, I go, oh, I mean, I can just feel myself sigh. I can feel my shoulders come down. I can feel myself relax, you know.
It's a metaphysical massage. Huh?
That's right. It really is. And so everybody, that's what we're going to talk about today. So if you do have A Course in Miracles, if you've got that workbook, turn it to lesson 79. And speaking of the chat room, thanks for posting that picture. And for everybody who's already there. But if you're new to the show and you want to go over into the chat room, we do have a private page over on Facebook that we use during our live shows here on 1-2 Radio. And you can find it by actually going to our radio website, which is 12radio.com. And on the left side of the page, you'll see a navigation column. And in that column, you'll see the word chat. And if you click on it, then you will be redirected over to Facebook where you can ask to join that particular group. And Scott Weaver is our producer today. Scott, thank you for being here. And he will make sure that you can join us in that room. And there you can join Jan and Greg and boy. Oh, hi, Eva. It's good to see you today. And also Elizabeth Lindsay and Renee, thank you so much for being early birds and for being here today as we talk about problems, and more problems. So let's get on with the show. I think most of you know my guest. He's here at least once a month, Bruce Rawls, who actually, you know, teaches and facilitates and is a participant in many Course in Miracles efforts. But he also does a lot of web design. So he's very involved in revising some of the websites that are associated with A Course in Miracles. So welcome, Bruce.
Thank you, CA. And I think really of myself as a student, and I think that's really very helpful. And we've talked about this in previous conversations, and that is that if I get it, I don't have to worry about if anybody else gets it. And at the same time, when the light bulb moments happen, and I listen to Holy Spirit, as of course would say, everyone benefits, and that's the fact that ideas don't leave their source. And I couldn't help but think about when the introductory remarks you made about how we all have these problems that never seem to cease. That it's kind of like one of Ken's workshops that I found very helpful and I listened to multiple times is his talk about. The Greek legend of Sisyphus, always
yes.
pushing the boulder up the hill. And that's really by design. The ego, by design is problem based. Its whole foundation is the premise is that there is a problem, that shouldn't really be looked at or addressed. And as long as we, as the Course points out with, not more than with, probably a lot more than just a little bit of humor. We always look for where the problem can't be resolved. It's like Jesus in his course points out, have you ever noticed that? Well, you're looking for solutions where the problems are never going to be found. The solutions are never going to be found. It's like, oh yeah, duh. But we need those reminders, don't we? That if we keep looking in a big hologram that we made up intentionally to keep us immersed in problems so that we could maintain our position on the throne of victimhood, we're just asking for that kind of trouble, aren't we? I mean, it's just kind of goes with the territory, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I'm glad you brought up Sisyphus. I feel like that ought to be my middle name sometimes. Well, and once again, because I'm special, I guess, everybody has that issue. But, sometimes I notice for me, I kind of enjoy it, I guess. It's like I'm really wanting to solve a problem that even other people in the world go, this is a moot point, CA. We don't even need to address this anymore. And I can't let it go. And so if you translate that spiritually, it's like, yeah, I love to be able to solve a problem, even if other people are going, I don't care anymore. It's not important.
Don't you think on some level or another, we're all doing that? And, may be dramatically different. But as the Course points out, is the content in the mind is still the same. We're all trying to fix a problem in a dream. And that's, again, the metaphysical reminder that this curriculum we're talking about is always and only about the mind, and the world, even modern physics will, the physicists that are not worried about their tenure or funding or whatever, if they really have any kind of leanings toward the philosophical implications of what things like the quantum entanglement and, all the quantum things that happened a few decades ago that basically transformed our world and even is providing the technology upon which we're communicating right now, recognition is that this world is really a perceptual distortion. Einstein even said that we're experiencing an optical delusion of consciousness because the form itself really is basically an interpretation of data that comes in that doesn't have any meaning to it until we ascribe meaning to it. And of course, from birth into a body, we quickly learn that there has to be meaning in order to survive. And that survival mechanism, of course, has all kinds of meaning construed to all these different seemingly separate objects and people and things that are safe and things that are dangerous. And those things shift around, one moment to the next, that something that's dangerous now can become safe and vice versa. And enemies become friends and friends become enemies. And it's a chaotic jumble of a world in terms of our ego's interpretation, isn't it?
I mean,
it's a mess.
Well, it is. And so, and we've talked about this before. I mean, personally, I just get so tired. I mean, when I said I read this lesson and I literally feel my shoulders kind of come back, because that's what I realize is I'm just kind of hunched over and just like, oh my God, what's the next thing? And then I read this and go, Oh, I mean, it's literally like it frees up my lungs to take in some oxygen or something, you know, to just take a breath and go, yeah, you forgot. You got all into this cycle. And it really can be like that feeling we have. You know, sometimes I'll wake up from a bad dream. And the minute I wake up and realize, I go, oh, that was just a dream. I don't even have to fix that. You know, I mean, and that, because that's it. You know, you're in the midst of the dream thing and I got to fix this. I got to fix this. And oh, my God. And it's like, oh, I don't have to do anything about that. That was just a bad dream.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's always, I think, important to point out for people, particularly new to the course, that this doesn't suggest that, you know, we all need to go off and live in caves or,
right.
or join an ashram or, you know, not that unless you're drawn to do that sort of thing. But for most people, as, you know, one of the suggestions in the manual for teachers suggests, you know, don't require lifestyle changes. It doesn't mean you behave differently necessarily, although there's a sense of ease, like you say, that happens when we recognize that the emphasis on, in that classic phrase that so many course students quote that says, I need do nothing, is on the word need. And mm-hmm. the need really is the interpretation, which is the judgment that we lay on our interpretations that suggest that our identity are the very core of what we believe ourselves to be, and our sense of worth and innocence and validity, and certainly our being as we believe it to be as a separate self is predicated and defined completely by what we do and don't do in the world. And so, you know, we have enormous amount of baggage and judgments around that. So to let that go and to, you know, recognize that I need do nothing doesn't mean we don't continue to do things. It's just we don't take it quite so seriously. And we can afford to, like you say, to kind of take a little deep breath and relax, you know. It's like it's not a big deal. And the letting go of the big dealness, I think, really is helpful.
Yes.
Would you mind if I read a little bit of Ken Wapnick?
Of course not. Please.
Okay. Yeah,
please.
Ken Wapnick has this, you know, three series of books on that are all about the three different main sections of A Course in Miracles. And this is his commentary on the Journey Through the Workbook in Lesson 79. He starts out by stating for this workbook, Lesson 79, that what is stated in this in the following lesson is that there is only one problem, although the world tells us there are many. The problem is the mind's belief we are separated from God and on our own. To repeat early discussions, the ego takes the single thought of separation, teaches us it is not in our minds but in the world, fragmenting the thought into billions and billions of different expressions of the one problem, each calling for a particular answer. Each problem thus commands attention, demanding to be solved in its own way. As we shall see below, this is an extremely frustrating situation because the true problem remains hidden in our minds, buried beneath the almost infinite number of external concerns that present themselves to us over and over and over again. This ensures that the external problem can never really be solved as we now read. And then he quotes the first sentence in Lesson 79, which is, a problem cannot be solved if you do not know what it is. Which really points to the ego's diversionary tactic of, it's in the world, you know, and of course, no, it's actually in the mind. But that's the outer shield of oblivion that A Course in Miracles talks about, which is basically, you know, let's do the massive magician trick of diverting attention to where the real action isn't happening, but appears to be happening, which is the world, so that the mind is never looked at. And as long as we do that, the ego can relax and it can just stay in this suspicious mode and not have to go to viciousness. But once we get to the mind, it's like, oh, okay, now you've, you know, thrown down the the challenge, you know, and it's now I got to respond with, you know, guard dogs and lasers and the full nuclear arsenal here And then it goes after us in a big way, because the idea of looking at the mind is like, oh, we can't go there because that's where all the unconscious guilt is. And the ego, of course, never phrases it that way, but that's the ultimate implication, is that if you look in the mind, you're going to be so terrified of what you see and it's going to destroy you. Well, the irony is it will eventually dissolve the ego, not all at once, but over time. And that's what the ego is afraid of. But that's not our real self. The real self that we truly all are as one being is completely independent of space and time and bodies and personas and all the temporal spatial stuff that we are so invested in and so fixated on and identified with in terms of being a problem solver in, right?
Right. Right. Well, and you know, one of the things I've been really paying attention to recently, and as an astrologer, I really do like the planet Saturn, which represents discipline, commitment, and a number of other things. But certainly part of its connotation, too, is that it limits us. Uh-huh. And it limits us because whatever we dedicate ourselves to, then we've basically turned against everything else. And what I cannot believe, I mean, it's just like jumping in my face. I've been reading a lot of Ken Wapnick recently because I told you I'm reading The Obstacles to Peace, which is, oh, my God, you know, what a book. But yeah. And of course, I've been reading also some of the commentary like you did today about, you know, the workbook lessons. And I'm using, you know, highlighters and pens and that kind of thing. And I'm highlighting every time I see the word dedicate. What do you dedicate yourself to? And there was like one paragraph, I don't know if it was in this lesson or if it was in the other book, Ken literally uses the word four times in one paragraph.
Wow.
And it gets my attention because, you know, and here again, I'm confusing levels. I'm talking astrology with spirituality. But the idea is with the ego, once again, I think sometimes we get into this, you know, we paint the ego as this monster and we have to fight. But the truth is, it always comes back to the mind. What are we dedicating ourselves to? It's a choice. Which belief system do you want to follow? One belief system, and because, you know, in a course, it continually tells us that ideas leave not their source. So, you know, it goes back to the matrix. Do you want the red pill, the blue pill, the green pill, whatever it is? But once you choose one, there is a whole belief system that goes with that. Uh-huh. And what do you dedicate yourself to over and over and over? What are you dedicating yourself to? What are you choosing? And yes, you're limiting yourself because now you go along with that belief system. But we continually think that somehow we can pick and choose and take all these different parts. In fact, even in this, I know Ken said something about, you know, of course, students fall into this trap all the time of believing miracles are things that externally change your life. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want the miracle that's going to make my schedule perfect. I want the miracle that's going to, you know, that's going to create my website. I want the miracle that's going
I can help with that.
Yes, you can. Yeah, you can.
that's doable. I mean, don't worry about that. Yeah.
But yeah, you know, somehow we have learned. I mean, once again, the Course in Miracles reinterprets so many words. We believe a miracle is somehow magically that our lives are going to get better. And in a course, it just continually tells us, don't look for the miracle in external things. And it doesn't mean that somehow your life doesn't feel better or this relationship doesn't feel better. But the miracle isn't changing the external world at all. It's changing what you believe to be true. It's allowing you to see, to choose the other pill, you know, the blue pill, green pill, whatever. It's allowing you to choose a different belief system. And as long as we keep going back to choosing what the Course calls the ego, then we're just buying into all that stuff. Okay, it's one big problem after another.
It is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there, a couple of thoughts come to mind as you're sharing that. One is one of Murphy's sub-laws that in my favorite of which is the Garth's distinction, very Zen Cohen-like one that this list of I probably shared this before, but I think it's fun and pertinent is there's one of the sub-laws that was in this list that circulated around my office a couple of decades ago before the internet, or maybe three or four, I guess. and it was the Zen one was Garth's distinction, which goes, there are two types of people in the world, those who divide people into two types and those who don't.
Yeah.
Which is a very good non-duality, you know, bit of humor there. And then the other one that seems to always come to the mind when I think of, you know, this this endless supply of problems that our inner Sisyphus, you know, wants to identify with, is, as Ken would say, is inside every little problem is a larger problem struggling to get out. That was one of the other sub-laws, yeah. Anyway,
but and just thank you for that. But that's it. The dedication of the ego. I mean, if you know, once again, what is the intention of the ego? And here's the other word that I keep coming across: purpose. Mm-hmm. What is your purpose? What is your dedication? What is your intention? Well, the ego always wants to keep us. That belief system really wants to keep us from thinking. Period. You know. Don't think. Don't go back to your mind. Don't decide whether or not this is logical or reasonable. Please don't do that.
Really?
And so that's the intention. And so once again, I mean, you know, I think we can go back and forth in terms of seeing the ego as evil, but it's basically just a belief system that is a fantasy and illusion. And what is it that you really intend? What do you want?
Yeah.
What's your purpose?
And that's such an important point, Sia, that the ego is not anything we need to fight. And if we find ourselves fighting, that's the ego doing the fighting,
yes.
Which is why you know, Jesus says in this wonderful course, he says, do not fight yourself. Because, you know, obviously, if you find yourself with a sword in your hand, you know, guess what thought system you're using? The whole idea is not to battle against the ego, it's to rise above the battleground by looking at the insanity of it, just watching the ego's desire and incessant demand that we fight and struggle against and see ourselves as the victim of or victimizer, depending, either way works, you know, to reinforce the unconscious guilt. And you know, then that basically has its strategy and its Machiavellian plans in the bag, you know, as long as we keep going along with that strategy. I couldn't help thinking too, because you mentioned the blue pill, red pill metaphor of the Matrix movies. And I was thinking, you know, in a sense, because the ego always tries to present, you know, this vast array of choices, although in the movie it was whittled down to one, you know, two colors of pills, mm-hmm. In a sense, our inner kindness teacher's option is one that isn't in a pill. It's not magic as the course would define it. It's basically the recognition that there is a choice that doesn't involve, you know, substituting one dream for another dream. It's basically looking at the dream from outside of it. And that's the only way we can do that, when we have those lucid moments of self-observation that are free of condemning thoughts, where we just say, wait a minute, I'm reacting to something someone said, and now I'm either wanting to you know get in the fight or wanting to recoil and feel bad, or, you know, no matter what the reaction is, if we basically feel like we're at the mercy of or being unmerciful toward anyone or anything in our world, that basically is a pill in the world that is just choosing among illusions instead of choosing against illusions by saying, I don't want the illusion, I want the reality. And that doesn't mean that you necessarily change your behavior, but it does mean that in that moment you look at the ego's strategy and look at its recommended thought and say, no, I don't think I'll go there this time. Or maybe you go there for a little while, but you say after a few minutes, it's like, this is not making me happy. You know, my decision for, you know, my rule for decision, you know, becomes, am I at peace? And if I'm not at peace, we do have the option to choose peace instead of the ego's this.
Right.
I could choose peace instead of this, you know.
Well, and jumping on to what you said before, in no, you know, with the course, it's like a lot of other things. You kind of go back and forth and back and forth in terms of where you land with stuff, and you make some mistakes along the way. But it's important, as Ken always said, be normal. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't telling you, okay, you have no problems, so just throw your hands up in the air and don't do anything today. You know, you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to do that. It's definitely of the mind. It's not telling you to just abdicate being a human, because we believe we are humans. We believe we are in bodies.
Exactly.
And finding that balance is what's tough, but it's once again, every time we feel like we're getting trapped into this is a real problem and spending all our time defining the problem instead of just once again coming back and saying there's another way to see this.
Yeah. You know, as you were saying that, it kind of struck me as, you know, what I think A Course in Miracles is really advocating is that not that we change the world. In fact, it says that in so many ways that, you know, it's not about changing the world, it's changing our perception of it. But I just kind of had this sort of visual of the Bruce character and the CA character and whoever's listening, you know, all the characters that we think we are, these dream figures, they basically continue to do the things they're responsible for and, you know, give themselves opportunity for having fun once in a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, but basically behave in a kind of, like you say, a normal way. But what shifts over time is the identity that I can see myself a little bit less and less as this surreal, you know, noir, a dystopian movie character, you know, that is struggling to break out of some horrific script and realize, wait a minute, on some level or another, I know that I wrote this script and I'm the playwright. I'm the screenwriter. I'm the author, you know, or the cartoonist or whatever metaphor you like. I'm the dreamer of the dream. And I don't have to identify with what the dream character is going through. And I think that's why this takes such a long time, because we're so resistant to it and because it takes so much practice to really implement the mindfulness that's suggested and the discipline. I like how you mentioned, you know, the emblem of Saturn, the symbol of Saturn, the glyph, which is, you know, essentially it's the only planet in our solar system that has a pronounced ring around it, although I think Jupiter was discovered by some of the Voyager missions to have a smaller ring. But the ring is kind of a neat symbol, isn't it? It basically says, here's a constraint, and mm-hmm. and the constraint can either be a positive or a negative, outcome, depending on which thought system you looked at it. So in what you were suggesting, which is in a line, I think, with what Of Course in Miracles is suggesting, is just to say no to the ego's denial of truth and being disciplined over time to say, I don't need that unconscious guilt. I can look at it, see that it's unfounded, and say no to it by looking at my judgments and looking at my condemnations, looking at my grievances as these workbook lessons that culminate in 79 and 82. And the last, you know, half a dozen or so are all about grievances. And as Tim Wise and Lynn Corona have been pointing out in their weekly online sessions I've been attending and great stuff. And so that's, you know, an opportunity to just look at how many grievances am I just dragging on because I'm afraid to allow the real identity that we all share, which is a completely joyous, happy one, to gradually replace this martyr victimhood, pretty abysmal, you know, dystopian version of myself, you know, in this movie. And if I can remember that, I can begin to take the dream a little less seriously, because, you know, the ring of Saturn either can constrain our choices to the ones that where they really make a difference, which is basically choosing against the ego's interpretation, or they can be taken on the level of form, identifying with the limitation and the belief in the problem, and the constraints that the world provides can actually be used by the Holy Spirit as a reminder to get back to the mind and saying, okay, what you really are is not limited, not constrained, doesn't require, is completely free, in truth, but the self that you think you are, the Bruces and the CAs and the whoever else is listening, those dream figures really are, you know, tremendously constrained. I mean, to a specific body, to a specific, you know, few decades of you know, mortal existence in our belief system. And that's, you know, pretty severe constraint right there, huh?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a couple of things that are coming into my mind, but since you were just talking about constraints, you know, I think about that even in the line of work that I'm in, because, of course, my colleagues believe in, or most of them, I should say, in a form of communication that goes well beyond the body. So we are communicating with people that have passed. We're communicating with people even on a level of things that are unsaid. We're communicating with angels or animals. And, you know, you have to move beyond some of those limitations if you're going to believe that communication exists outside of the actual form. And once again, it was kind of interesting because in the journey, you know, with the obstacles that I'm reading of Ken, he talks about how one of the obstacles that, you know, we're attracted to, and I mean, I know this is very complicated, so don't go there, people, but it's death. And he said, you know, you believe that death can effectively stop communication. And he goes, but that's what you realize eventually. It cannot stop communication. It cannot stop the memory. You know, why is Jesus such a figure in our lives right now if death could stop it? It can't. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, oh, even Ken is talking about, you know, this communication thing. And I just thought about that, you know, in fact, that was kind of jarring also as I was reading that, because he said, you know, people mistakenly think that they can literally escape through death. Yeah, and he goes, yeah. It's in your mind, people. You know, if your mind carries the idea, if you're committed to, if you're dedicated to separation, then yeah, you can get rid of the body, but that doesn't change the belief system. And I thought, whoa, you know, because boy, that's kind of a jolt. But anyway, just that whole idea. But the other thing I wanted to go back to, too, is even in, I think it's lesson 80, it says, let us be determined not to collect grievances today. And, you know, I think about that. You know, would you kind of hang a sign around your neck going, I'm a grievance collector? And yet, we all are. I have my whole bag of grievances. If you start on a certain topic, I will have five stories. And, let me tell you my victim situation with the bank or with the whatever, you know, with the IRS, with furniture. I don't care what it is. You know, I've got my favorites. And I'm a collector of grievances. And, you know, I really think about that. Can we kind of redefine that, or can we laugh at ourselves and say, really? Is that what we want to be? I say, hey, what do you collect? You know, Bruce, oh, I collect grievances about such and such, you know?
That is so funny and so true. And I couldn't stop, you know, I was chuckling for a moment thinking about just one that popped into my mind that, you know, it's an example of how we revel in our, not only our grievances, but our special, finely honed craft of victimhood and, you know, and persecution. And, you know, even if we don't think we're literally being persecuted, you know, or put upon by various elements of our culture or environment or our bodies or, you know, whatever it is, even our humor. You know, the things that we do for entertainment are oftentimes oriented about that, oriented toward that. And the one that crossed my mind is, I don't know where this came from, but one of my colleagues at a company I used to work for in Grass Valley, California, sent me an email once that had this little line that said, you know, and it was basically quoting a phone message that he had heard. And it was, for a list of reasons how automated phone menus have not improved your life, press 1 now. Anyway.
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, just kind of like we can find reasons to be upset with literally everything in this world. And that's really by design. I think that's why Ken, you know, is so eloquent in pointing out that, you know, we want the problems and we revel in them. We savor them because it justifies a separate existence, only because there's fear behind that we don't want to look at. Mm-hmm. But we're never really happy until we do look at it and see that it's nothing. There's nothing there, that the unconscious guilt is unfounded, and then we can move on. And once we get little glimpses of that, and I think a lot of times it happens, which I think is again more to Ken's brilliance, where he says in the journey through the manual preface that, you know, it's really trusting that inner kindness teacher, aka Holy Spirit, is one aspect of the process, and another is the shared interest. When we recognize that, when we appreciate and enjoy, in a sense, you could say vicariously, someone else's true happiness, that's when we're recognizing that minds are joined, and there really isn't anything that we can't appreciate and enjoy in truth that is is limited to any one person or thing. Earlier you mentioned death, and I was thinking, well, that works in both directions of time. I was thinking, I just finished reading Gary Renard's fourth book, which is wonderful, the lifetimes that Jesus and Buddha knew each other. I don't know if you've read that one, but it's outstanding. And I was thinking, there's a lot of people I know who when they first learn of these books, say, well, how did these come from? You say, well, they came from this fellow named Gary Renard, who had two ascended masters who appeared on his couch a number of years ago and began to tell him about how, essentially they were his future self and his future wife who he hadn't met at the time. And so people say, well, is this real? And the whole point of what they're sharing and what he shares in these books is, is this real? Right. It's like, no, the bodies that we're hanging out in here to make a point is not to impress in a show and tell, not a show and tell, to try to impress the importance of the body. It's basically just the opposite. It's basically to say that, what we really are is spirit. And it doesn't matter what the form the message gets through. It's really the message that's important that suggests that we really are all innocent. We're all one. And that our problems not only can be looked at it from a different way, but then from that different perspective, they are solved. Can I read a little bit more of Ken's commentary?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll just pick up where I left off in his commentary on Lesson 79. I've got so much of this underlined and highlighted, I could really spend several more hours, but I think this is all really good. So Ken goes on to say, we could also say that a problem cannot be solved if we do not know where it is, which is virtually the same thing. The where is the mind, and the what is our decision to be separate. Remember, the whole point of the ego, indeed the whole point of its thought system of separation, culminating in the making of the world of separation, is to see that we never realize where and what the problem is. It cannot be overemphasized that purpose is everything, and the only way to undo the ego is to change the purpose it gave the world, to conceal the problem, to the Holy Spirit's purpose of revealing the problem so it can be undone. Let me recognize the problem so it can be solved. And immediately my mind jumps to, since you mentioned the Matrix movie, what a great service those movies did in reminding us that, this whole holographic dream of a world is like a Matrix. It's like a giant, conspiracy of a fake self that we made up to pull the wool over our own eyes in an incredibly convincing way, more photorealistic than the best, sci-fi movie and with all of its CGI imagery and animation that we can muster. I mean, we've bought into this hook, line, and sinker, but it's a dream. It's a massive holographic hoax that we bought into. And that, I think, is part of recognizing that the problem is not in the dream. It's with the dreamer. It's with the playwright. It's with the screenwriter.
Mm-hmm. And that little section you just read, he used the word purpose three times.
Mm-hmm. Why? Yeah.
And it's somewhere else in the course. I don't know if it's the text or the workbook. There is something that says, what you should always be asking yourself is, what is this for?
Mm-hmm.
What is this for? This thought, this idea, this behavior, what is it for? Yep. And we don't tend to do that. We don't tend to question ourselves about, simple things like, what is this for?
We Matrix zombies as robots do not question our programming. Last night, my wife and I watched the sequel to the Blade Runner movie, and I couldn't help but notice some of the dialogue had a lot of interesting metaphysics in it. But, as often is the case, a lot of these certainly more intense edge of the seat kind of movies are, certainly, but can give you a lot of, certainly the violence and the frustration and the terror that comes with those kind of films. But at the same time, the dialogue was, I kept saying, okay, Holy Spirit, you know, I wasn't using these words exactly, but, you know, I kept asking, like, what was the metaphysical message here? And so much of the dialogue they were using was like, wow, what a revelatory comment about, you know, the ego is exposing itself and its folly, you know, out of every word, out of its mouth kind of thing, you know, and that, but that's really how I think we need to look, not in a judgmental way, but just like, as Ken, I keep coming back to this favorite phrase of Ken's, is that the ego is not wicked or evil, or sinful. It's just silly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a mistake.
It's a mistake. You know, why would we invest our identity in a dream figure that's limited, you know, far, far more tightly than the rings of Saturn? You know, our little personal world is constrained to, you know, pretty small, small sector of a third rate planet in the edge of a, you know, a backwater galaxy, you know, and we, but boy, we defend that turf, you know, relentlessly, don't we? I mean, it's just,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just looking at that gently and mindfully, and just like you say, as I notice myself, you know, speeding up in my conversation, just, you know, step back and say, I can afford to relax. I could see peace instead of this.
Yes.
And I'm not upset, except for the reason I think, which is the choice in the mind is really the real reason. Yeah.
Yeah. And in these lessons, I mean, some of the takeaway from these two, and I hope people will go back and read them. And of course, they're coming up, I think, in, let's see, March 20th and 21st, if you're following, you know, one lesson a day in the workbook. But, you know, there's a few takeaway things, which for me are really helpful. And one of those is one problem, one solution.
Yes. Yes.
Just one problem, one solution. It doesn't feel that way. There are many, 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 many forms. And like I said, I don't want to get into this. Okay, I don't have to worry about any problems. I don't have to do anything. I can just go one problem, one solution. But, you know, in your head, in your brain, in your mind, when you just need to, you know, return to that state of peace, there's one problem and there's one solution. And the problems have already been solved, because the ability to literally separate yourself from God, from your creator, from your divine source is impossible. Mm-hmm. It never happened. It can't happen. And yes, there's a whole matrix. There's a whole, you know, world that we have created. What if, what if, what if, what if? And yes, we can enjoy that and we can also suffer through it. But ultimately, there's one problem and there's one solution. And if we're really interested in kind of coming back to peace of mind, then we can come to that place. But most of the time, if I'm honest with myself, I'm not looking for peace of mind. I'm looking to be right.
Yep.
You know, I'm looking to establish myself. I'm looking to make an impression.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know.
And that joy is really, you know, fleeting at best, and it's probably more accurately described as a euphoria, which is, you know, when we really look at the things that we think make us happy that happen or don't happen in the world, really, we're ascribing meaning to something that truly doesn't have any. And not to say that we shouldn't enjoy the things in our world, mm-hmm. you know. But I think if we can just cultivate a gentle, you know, inner smile and watch, you know, as we go after and try to, you know, have these conquests of things that I wanted this job or this relationship or this you know, physical condition for my body or for my finances or for, you know, whatever it is, you know, it could be an ecological quest, you know, to try to solve, you know, social and environmental problems. It could be, or whatever, you know, it doesn't really matter what the nature of it is. It's just, if we can just do the things that we would do anyway, but with a little bit more of an inner inner smile and say, oh yeah, This is really a dream that I am not the victim of, but I can contribute the peace to this. And I like how toward the end of the second of the two workbook lessons, lesson 80, paragraph 8, in the middle of the sentence on sentence 3, he says, all that is necessary is to entertain some doubt about the reality of your version of what your problems are. It's not saying you don't have to, you know, believe everything that's said here and just, you know, instantly. That's not going to happen anyway. But if we can just entertain a little doubt and to begin to question the dream that is the script of our lives as being the final word on everything, you know, especially when you kind of go back and look at things that were big issues and huge tormenting problems. It can be as little as a week or a day ago, but certainly the things that haunted us as in early middle age or adolescence or childhood. If we can kind of just reflect on some of those things that were huge problems for us and say, well, where are those now? It's like, well, I don't know, because the past is gone, right? And so if we can extrapolate and say, well, this present is going to be a past pretty quick. In fact, what was just then present is now past. We can realize that the only moment that we really can find peace in truly is now, and that's the eternal opportunity that we have to let go of this crazy dream and our identification with it, huh?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting also that you said the past and present and future, or the allusion to time, because here again, I'm sorry, I don't remember where I read this, somewhere in the text, I think. And it's interesting because it literally says, if you will just kind of wake up, if you'll just entertain, as you said, some of these ideas, don't you realize that you can be released from the past torturing you? Mm-hmm. That wasn't the exact word, but that's exactly what it felt like. Like, you don't have to be tortured by the past, by past decisions, whether I did it right, I did it wrong, whatever. And if you can be released from the torture of the past, then it frees up your present moment and it you don't really have is. To dread the future. Mm-hmm. Because that's all, time is also just part of the illusion that there's past, present, and future instead of it's all going on at the same time. Or, if it's all one big fantasy, or if you think about it, I like to think of it as a movie. I've got that DVD, the movie's all there, and I can pop in and look at any scene I want. And so if you could somehow see it that way, you can be released from those past scenes, at least from the torture of your judgment of those past scenes.
Exactly. And I think when we choose that inner kindness teacher, a.k.a. Holy Spirit, of Course in Miracles, what we're doing is we're basically saying that the ego's director's cut audio, that, we can turn on and off. We just turn it off. And then the piece that's behind that, you could think of that as the inner kindness teacher's commentary, but most of the time it's basically just reminding us that nothing's going on here. I'm reminded of there's a I'm not sure where it came from, but it's kind of a story or something about the footsteps in the sand and It's sort of usually in a religious context, like looking back over your lifetime and when, Jesus and you were having this conversation kind of thing. And I'm going to paraphrase this greatly because I can't even remember where it came from exactly. But it was something to the effect of, when you ask that gentle presence, how come there are places, when there's only, looking back across the metaphoric beach of the mind, there's some places where there's only one set of, footprints,
yeah.
And so, I carried you during those times, and I think that's kind of equivalent to the times when we are off in our dream identification, and of course reminds us, well, nothing's really happening. Nothing's being recorded in truth. There's a dropout on the tape because nothing happened.
Yeah.
When you play back the recording and we're blathering on and on about our problems and our proposed solutions that we think are going to, make the dream work, in truth, the cosmic recorder says, oh, there's nothing happening here. You don't have to record this, basically. Mm-hmm. Which kind of ties into years ago when I was living in Southern Oregon, Tom Carpenter, we arranged to have him give a talk, and he was a wonderful day-long presentation. And what stuck out for me is the highlight is he was talking about his inner teacher. He referred to his brother, and which was his reference to Holy Spirit. And he said he was looking back over his life and asking him, what about all the places where I messed up, all the things that I felt horrible about. And he was kind of going on and making this list of, all the diatribe of all these transgressions and things he, didn't feel particularly great about that he was, involved in. And Tom said that response was just silence, meaning, you know, taking that to mean nothing happened. You know, why would you let him, you know, belabor what never happened? And I think if we can just remember, you know, I'm just going to reread that sentence I read, but preface it with the two before it in the end of workbook lesson 80. Says, this is the first paragraph of first few sentences of paragraph 8 in that workbook lesson. Okay. And he says, the exercises for today will be successful to the extent to which you do not insist on defining the problem. Perhaps you will not succeed in letting all your preconceived notions go, but that is not necessary. All that is necessary is to entertain some doubt about the reality of your version of what your problems are. I might as well finish it. He said, you're trying to recognize that you have been given the answer by recognizing the problem, so that the problem and the answer can be brought together and you can be at peace. And I think that's, you know, the clue is that if we look for the solution in the world, we're trying to find the solution where it is never going to be found, because the problem was made in the mind by choosing a thought system of duality, of separation. And we only are going to get back to the mind by looking at our projections, aka the world, without judgment, without condemnation, and just say, wow, this is like that you know scary, surrealistic, futuristic, you know, dystopian noir film that I like I was watching last night. It's like, this is just a silly dream. This has no bearing on the reality that I am and have, and that you are and have, and that we all share. And so as long as I keep looking at the problem where it really is in the mind and bringing that to the altar of my mind, you know, for our inner kindness teacher to look at it with us, it dissolves. And that's how the problem and the answer are brought together, the problem and the solution, you know, like matter and antimatter, you know, you bring those together and they both dissolve into light. You know? That's kind of...
Well, and somewhere, I'm glad you said that, because somewhere else in the workbook, it actually says, has it ever occurred to you that you separated yourself from the answer?
Yeah.
And I loved that too, because so often when I'm, you know, perplexed, I always think there is no answer. And so that idea of, you know what, there's always an answer, and has it occurred to you, you just simply separated yourself from it. What a relief. Oh my gosh, I can just get back together with the answer.
Exactly. The answer is not by, you know, traversing an endless maze, the matrix world of the ego. The answer is to not eat a red or a blue pill, but to get above the battleground, you know, kind of like looking at the mice in the maze and saying, I'm not the creature in the maze. I'm the one who designed the maze.
The maze, right?
And that's amazing.
Yes. and on that note, Bruce, we have 2 minutes, actually 1 minute, to wrap up the show.
Oh, wow.
And I will post your blog sites, your websites in the chat room as we're finished. But is there anything you want to announce really quickly before we close the show today?
You know what? I think since we've talked, there's a new as some of you may know, I'm helping Foundation for Inner Peace work on a new website, and it's coming along nicely. But the sister organization for the Foundation for A Course in Miracles does have a new website. That's at facim.org. The other one, of course, is acim.org, which is underway. But the new one at facim.org, which is Ken Wapnick's material, and all the wonderful work that has been done since then that they're planning to make available, in addition to just the video streaming classes and in-person classes that they've done. Anyways, they've done a great job with the new website. And one of the things I think is really cool is not only have they added more material that was kind of buried, if you hadn't noticed it before, but also there's a neat little glossary of terms. And these terms, if you roll over any word that's got a hyperlink next to it, it'll pop up with a definition. So you get everything in the context. So all these definitions that the course uses to redefine, you know, traditional religious words in a way that actually is helpful – you know, it's right there. It's pretty cool. So I encourage people to visit that website.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I'm posting some of these in the, in the chat room. And by the way, I have seen the new website at the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, and it is really incredible. So yeah. Thank you for all your work on that. And Bruce, thanks so much for being here today and talking about problems. And I look forward to another discussion and also just working with you on my website. Bruce is helping me with that. So thank you very much. And I want to say thanks to our producer today, Scott Weaver. And thanks to all the listeners and everybody in the chat room for your participation. It always makes it just so much more interesting and fun for me to see you there and to read those comments. So I hope that you will stick around, because we've got a lot of live programming coming up next. And then please join me next Tuesday for my other show, Simple Tales. So until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You have been listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality. And by the way, one more comment. If you feel like you've got problems, well, guess what? We're doing a 3-day sale on 1-2-listen.com. So come and find me over there and let's discuss that. One solution, one problem. Okay. Bye-bye, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks.